brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast.
Hello everyone, Dr. Spork here. This episode is a re-roll from a chat that Matthew had with Brent Spivey back in early 2023. Brent's Mayhem and Rogue Planet remain, for Matthew, two of the most fascinating and innovative rule systems in the entire hobby. They kicked things off by talking about his mass fantasy classic, Mayhem, where Matthew asked him about its scale agnosticism.
Yeah, it's pretty flexible in that, you know, and you know, size isn't so much of a difference because the distances, I think, work either way. It's probably better for 10 or 15 as far as the scale looks, but perfectly fine for 48, like old school Warhammer style as well.
So what sort of stuff are we going to need to play a game of Mayhem then, apart from our armies, like in terms of dice and playing size and stuff?
Really, that's about it. If you've got your armies, you just need some dice, something to be able to measure with. The dice do use a typical D20 RPG dice, so you'll need an assortment of different types of D4s, D6s, D8s, 12s, 20s. But other than that, that's really it. There's not a lot of record keeping or bookkeeping. There's no casualty removal, so...
Yeah, that's the first thing that I was sort of looking at. So we've got this mechanic where we've got a stat line from what I could see, and the three main things we're looking at is well, you've got your movement, you've got your combat quality, and you've got your ballistic armor rating. And these, correct me if I'm wrong, seem to be represented by different types of dice.
Correct, yeah. And I thought the dice were great, you know, in this game in particular, especially for simulating mass battle, we've got that, default versus danger system. So default means you can either take half the value of the dice, so a D8 is a D4, D6 is a 3. But you can also have danger where you're rolling the dice to try to get a little extra movement, so that D8, instead of moving the steady D4, you can try to push across the field. And this, you know, I think it kind of elegantly maps, unequal footing or people being unsure or mixed up in orders and command structure. And it also makes it where you can't exactly calculate how far you're going to be able to go on any given movement or what your opponent's going to do. So it adds a bit of uncertainty to the battlefield. And I, for me, that was a nice, I think, decision point to start with, because it's a choice every time you pick up the dice. Am I going to roll this? Am I going to try to get more dice to get a higher average? Or am I going to, you know, play it safe and go with the steady, you know, plotting and predictability. And, you know, I think it plays to personalities and play styles.
Yeah, I really like that, because if you compare it to like, say, Warhammer or Kings of War, which I'm, you know, I don't dislike as a game, but when you line up your forces on the table, anyone with half a brain could see, you know, well, they move this amount, they move that amount. We know exactly when everyone's going to meet, because it's just basic maths and turn sequence. Like, we know it's all going to go to plan like that. Whereas with this, you're like, well, I don't know, you know, or I could really be focusing, because, like, I'm going to touch on in a second, we've got this sort of command points, resource management structure, we've got the overdrive mechanic as well. So you could really spend a bit of time in one area of the battlefield, putting all your resources into one maneuver, rather than just this like straight line maneuver towards each other and like we'll all have at it, like a sort of sporting event.
Yeah, and without kind of jumping ahead too much, I'll let you kind of lead the discussion on the mechanics. But yeah, when we start talking about overdrive and the command points, it does allow you to, I from a design point, I talk about this in Rogue Planet too, I call it like shifting the camera. We're gonna watch this flank for a moment, or we're gonna watch the center line of the battle. And it also means, instead of, like you said, two big lines that are gonna push across the field towards one another, we have an opportunity to, you know, let's send, you know, forth a, you know, a probing force on the flanks, or some fast cavalry, or let's focus on shooting first. And now, instead of, you know, we could, you know, like you just said, in these other games, I don't want to say they're bad games, but we know that you're going to march across the field, straight across the field. Everyone's going to be X number of inches from each other. And there's a little bit of maneuverability here. I think, you know, we've created something where you've got every option available depending on what you want to do and how you've built your force, and theme them as well. I think the theme is important too.
So that this command points system, like I was saying, it's resource management. You've got a set amount of command points, and that will be determined when you're putting your army together, won't it? You'll get a dice to determine how many command points you're going to get. Is that right?
Correct. And you know, you can have that to where it's set or variable as well. So you can play it safe and try to have, you know, more orders or commands, or you can, you know, roll the dice and try to get a little bit of extra out and, you know, send a few more orders out there. So once again, am I going to be able to activate 3 units, 4 units, and am I going to focus on doing multiple things with that unit if I've got a lot of command, kind of focus my attention and orders on a specific area of the battlefield as well. So that command and control element, I think, is well represented by that too. It's not just everyone's going forward. It's I'm giving orders. How many things can I do effectively? Or is that even important to me? Do I want to focus on individual elements and push aspects of the battle?
And the overdrive mechanic as well. I mean, it seems like this gives us the opportunity to really push the boat out on one particular unit or something like that. You know, you've given a lot of examples in the book. You've got a unit of orcs. With a bit of a push, they could maybe get somewhere and attack someone. They could maybe even get back out of the way, but it's going to cost you. You're going to accumulate command points. It's going to cost more and more, but it gives you the possibility to sort of put your neck out and try something like that, doesn't it?
It does. And it costs you more, you know, the overdrive for people who don't know the game. As you give a command an overdrive, it costs a little more each time, but that focus allows you to push them further. So, yeah. So if your opponent's thinking, oh, I've got this line marching straight forward me, and now all of a sudden those orc berserkers that you have can charge straight in. It's a nice bit of disruption and keeps things a little less predictable. Which I think is fun, but it also keeps the analysis paralysis out of it because you really, there's too many vectors and possibilities to predict everything. So you're more playing the opponent and their style as opposed to the army and heuristics of the situation.
On the movement as well, it looks like there's maybe an advance mechanic where you could line up ranks of troops and move them together. Have I interpreted that properly?
You did. And that's one of those things where, you know, let's say I have, you know, 3 units of spearmen or, you know, some spearmen and pikemen flanked together. If I put them together and give them a standing order, they will just start marching across the field at their default. And so that's kind of like taking them out of the command point. So, you know, if I've got 3 to 6 units in the middle of the field that I've put together that are just going across, now I can focus on the flanks or some shooting or flying my hero across on a dragon while they're just moving. And to me, that kind of represents, you know, this is the plan before the battle. It's your one simple order. You're going to do this thing. And then as they meet the enemy or the formations get disrupted, all that falls apart. And now you're not nearly as efficient. So you're modeling that chaos of battle and the lack of efficiency once you meet engagements as well. But there's not a lot to track with that either. So I think, yeah, that was another goal of the system is let's have it. We're up front. We can do these. We can kind of put everything on autopilot. We're not, you know, working this out and, you know, micromanaging it. And then as the battle progresses, you can respond to how the enemies attacked you or successes you didn't think you were going to get in battle as well.
Yeah, I like that because although like with games, it's not about being super realistic, but it's still nice to have these nods to realism throughout your narrative. And I like that fact that, you know, these units of troops, they don't have like the internet, they don't have the general on the phone, you know, keep going and micromanaging. It's going to be the case where it's like, look, lads, I'll be away over here. So you guys just need to keep moving forward until the situation changes. So it gives that element of the general can't be everywhere. Sometimes he's just got to delegate and leave it alone and see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. And like, you know, you brought up an important point. I think it's kind of important in most design. You've got, you know, simulation where you're trying to exactly model something. And for me personally, I try to avoid that and go for the feeling of a thing. And, you know, just to get the right abstraction so that it feels like you're doing a thing without actually having a 10-step guide to model ultra realism. And that's kind of always one of my design goals. Let's provide a feeling of the thing, the essence of it, without actually simulating it step by step like you would with a computer program or a hardcore war game that gets into, you know, to drive types and vehicles and calculating ground hardness and whatnot.
Yeah, it's raining a bit now. We need to change that.
Right.
So on the movement and distances, do we stay with inches no matter what scale we're going with? Do we just keep it in inches, or do we move to centimeters, or is there anything like that?
You can switch between the two, and as long as you're consistent, you know, and the old doubling trick that you can do with war games to kind of make it similar, it's fine either way. And I tell people, you know, adapt to what you think looks and feels right, and also the size of your battlefield. If you're going to be playing on a coffee table as opposed to a classic gaming table or the kitchen table, you know, sometimes centimeters with the smaller unit sizes as well. If you're playing something really small, you know, like a 10 millimeter game, that can work well too. I think consistency is the key, and I'm not really, for me personally, I'm never like size or scale agnostic unless it really means something in the system. And I think it's more personal taste. And I like to leave that to the players running the game.
Could you talk to us a wee bit about the combat system then, and how we actually get to the fighting, whether that's melee or shooting at people?
Yeah, so with the combat, once you get stuck in, the dice system where, you know, you're rolling higher for like ranged attacks or higher for movement, lower rolls are going to be better for combat. So you're trying to get combos of sets of dice to roll under your opponent, with ones being automatic elimination or things that'll try to rout your enemy. And because it is a mass scale battle game, we're looking to get bonus dice for, you know, having a flank, the enemy flanked or someone on their rear. You're going to get multiple chances, and that's just going to push up your odds of getting those lower numbers. And once again, you can always take the default value. So if I'm in combat and I've got a really, you know, low die type, like a D6, I can take the 3 and tell my opponent, hey, you've got to try to roll under this or not, and put the pressure on them so I can be very consistent. Or it also gives you the chance for that goblin with a D12 melee ability to make a dice roll on a 1 and hit that, you know, crucial shot where they get it done. So once again, another decision point. Do I roll? Do I not? Do I take the default and force my opponent to make the roll? I find it works pretty well. And once again, no casualty removal. So we're going to be, you know, either routing the enemy, making them flee, or wiping them out completely.
And with that one being a critical hit as well, have you heard a lot over the years of people saying, oh, I'll be great at this because I roll loads of ones? Do you hear a lot of that?
oh, yeah, always. And people either love it or hate it. And it's great when it's, you know, for them or when it's against them. But, you know, statistically and balance wise, it works. It's just, you know, any dice game are always going to feel away when you make a roll. Yeah, you always get the stories of, you know, my opponent rolled 4 ones against me, or, you know, just the opposite. I rolled, you know, 420s on a D20 in a row and did me nothing. So yeah, you know, that's war game stories though, right? Miniatures. You always have those battles where you've beat the odds or rolled the crits or the doubles. And I enjoy those.
On the resolve and harm section, there's something I can't quite figure out, which is no slight on you. It's just that I'm terrible at interpreting rules and reading books.
No.
I can see that you can do, there's the disorder. So if you do harm to a unit, you're going to put a disorder token on them. And as far as I could see, if a unit has a disorder token and you inflict any more harm on them, they're eliminated. But I'm curious as to how, because it talks about having several disorder tokens. So how do you actually get more than one disorder token?
There are certain abilities in there that can allow you to have more disorder tokens. But if by and large, if you're not a monstrous unit or, you know, something that uses, you know, wounds, it's, you know, one disorder token is going to put you in disarray. If you don't rally and get that token off, the next attack is going to rout you. And, you know, that's another way in the system that we keep it kind of simple. So you're not removing casualties. How many people did you, you know, how many creatures did you hurt or eliminate? Enough to disorder them and make them flee. The next one, did you rout them completely or run them off the battlefield? But yeah, you understood it right. You just have to look through like different abilities, and there's different ways, and with expansions that you can put more disorder tokens on, or like heavy armor will allow you to have, say, a second disorder token. So if a unit has heavy armor, it gives them a little more staying power. So they've got two. The third attack, once they've got both those on, will route them.
It's like that jab hook kind of twofold, like I'll disorder you, I'll kill you. Like it reminds me a bit of, we were playing recently Song of Blades and Heroes, and a big tactic with the fighting there seems to be knock the guy on his arse, then kill him. Like that seems to be like, you can kill somebody when they're standing up, but a lot of it is knock them down and kill them. So disorder them and kill them. Along the
exactly,
similar lines,
yeah, we want to get chaos in the ranks, and like I say in the rules too, you know that you know, you theme it how you want. Did I route them off the field? And you know, some units will actually flee away from you on certain attacks. So when you attack them and run them down, you know, did they just flee completely? Did you, you know, leave them as a bloody stain on the field of battle? It's up to your narration, you know, which I'm a big fan of, and that's, you know, up to theming it up to the player. But either way, they're not in play anymore.
And we're looking at in harm as well. We've got disorder for your sort of standard human units, but then if we're dealing with like big monsters or stuff like that, it seems like we switch to damage. Or if we're looking at huge, massive hordes of things, we're looking at attrition. These are other ways of doing harm, aren't they?
Yes, sir. There are, and those are more to just give you a difference. One, if I think with like a horde, especially. Or a big monster, you're going to spend a lot of time modeling these units or making a vignette with a large creature in the middle of a horde. So if I've got a giant troll that's in the middle of a bunch of goblins or something, not only have I spent time modeling it and painting it, I want it to be on the table a little bit longer. And I think attrition gives you a chance to have it in the game. And it also models a different type of, you know, a different type of threat. I need to handle this a little bit differently. And the same thing with damage. If I've got a monster that has damage on them, they're going to stick around a little bit longer. And I can't just do that 1-2 punch. Now I've got to have a different attack and try to whittle them down. And they present a different kind of threat to deal with as well.
Yeah, so that with the damage, that's the point where your natural one doesn't automatically get rid of them, does it? There's a bit more to it than that.
Right. We're looking at, you know, the difference between the die rolls, and that's going to determine how many wounds or damage we put on the creature. So, so they are the one that you've come to rely on, and other things not quite as important. So you kind of have to shift gears. And to me, that's also a mental shift in what kind of threat it is. And it makes it feel more dangerous, or like it's going to do a little more damage, and have to take care of it differently as well. So
can you talk a wee bit about the soft and hard counters system then?
Yeah, soft and hard counters, that's kind of inspired, like when I think of these kind of games, I say these kind of like mass battle games, I always go back to like Age of Empires and Age of Mythology and those RTSs with my units moving across the field. And, you know, the rock, paper, scissors of those games I enjoy. So I wanted to have a light element you could do that, you know, made the weapons in there feel a little more thematic. So the hard and soft counters are kind of a nod to the rock, paper, scissors. I'm going to have, you know, spears are better against, you know, cavalry and things like that. But here, instead of just adding more dice or extra dice, we can actually shift the die types one or two steps. So that reward. So once again, if I have a D10 for my CQ ability, if I've got a hard counter and I step that down to a D6, my odds of eliminating them and doing damage are much better. Also, it's a way of min-maxing your stats on the field. And what I mean by that is, if I, you know, it's obviously cheaper to give someone a higher die type for melee. So if I spend less money on a D10 or D12, but I use them effectively on the field to turn them into a D8 or a D6 or D4, now I'm getting a lot more value out of them because of something I've done tactically, not because of my list building ability, but what I do in play. So it makes them more valuable in the space. And I think that's an important distinction and part of the, you know, reason we did the hard and soft counter system is to reward you in play with better statistics and a better chance of eliminating the enemy.
So you're looking at, you know, I've got this block of troops. They're specialist at killing that block of troops over there. I'm going to really go after them because I know that this is what this group of troops are trained to do.
Right. They might do fine, you know, against, you know, they might do fine, you know, their D10 against rank and file, but you put them against their hard counter. Now they're a D6, which rolling, you know, lower, rolling a one is much better. And, you know, it's more economical to have them in my force if I'm, you know, spending less but getting proper matchups. But also, you know, quantity has a quality all its own as well. I start getting enough flanks and enough other things and rolling dice on attacks, I'll probably get my numbers as well to get attacks. So both are viable, specialist, generalist, and positioning, I think all come into play, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And when we've got two units of troops that come together in combat, of course, there's always the opportunity for a tie. It looks like if we both roll a one, we could kill each other, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that's just basically, you know, in my mind, they've done enough damage to leave two or three troops left on the field that aren't battle worthy or are just like, I've had enough of this. I'm out of here. So they're going to flee the field of battle. Right. You know, or if, you know, you got some big monsters or something, they stabbed one another and finished each other off. So, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like
I always remember that photo back in the day. It was like a crocodile had eaten a python or vice versa. A python had eaten a crocodile or an alligator. And they both died, you know. And it was like the python's lying there with like bits of crocodile burst out its belly and it was dead too. So I imagine it as that. They both rolled a one.
That's it. Yeah, both rolled a one. Perfect.
With the deadlock then, if we don't kill each other, it looks like, you know, we're at this impasse, but there's deadlock abilities from what I could see. So was it page 17? Again, good for the audio when I'm looking through a book. The turtle deadlock, the shield wall. So it looks like there's two deadlock abilities there.
Yeah, so the deadlocks just give you a chance for something interesting to happen when you roll a tie. So, you know, you can push an enemy back physically on the field or, you know, do other things. And it just gives you, I think, ties in addition to, well, the double kill, if you have abilities or a time for something interesting to happen. And so that's kind of what those abilities bring forward. It's just, you know, a chance for something interesting to happen that adds to the story and changes the tactical makeup just a little bit. And another way to theme your army and kind of add a little more character in there.
When we're putting together an army, then I'm looking at sort of how I'm going to stat things up. I'm looking at, you know, there's costs associated with die type when I'm building all my stats. And then we have like special abilities and traits and stuff as well, don't we? You could add in extra standards that are going to give you additional rolls when you're getting your command points, can't you?
You can. Yeah, and that's, most of my games and these two in particular, Mayhem and Rogue Planet, it's pretty much free form. I don't have a lot of restrictions on building unless it just is something that doesn't work mechanically. So you can add as many things to a unit as you want or as few or spend what you like. And yeah, the standards are a way to, you know, give you more command points and more dice when you're rolling and kind of expand your abilities across the field as well. So you know, it's another way to tie in the modeling with actual abilities because, you know, people like units with standards and musicians and all the things. And this gives you a chance to have them actually give you an impact in the game and a reason to be there.
Are there resources online where you could find like army templates for Mayhem or like quick reference guides or anything like that?
We have on Wargame Vault, you can go, they have a Battle Scribe builder that one of the fans of the game created, and we also have like some custom armies in there. So if you wanted to go in and like build something real quick and get some example armies, it's on there, obviously. And if you download the game on Wargame Vault, it comes with army builder sheets and quick references that kind of help you jump into it. But the Battle Scribe files, if you like a typical computer-based army builder, is kind of nice and quick to get in there. And there's some really good blogs out there too, some blogs where people are really active, you know, making their forces and sharing what they've done. But I always tell people it's kind of nice too, just to, you know, once you've read through the book, put all your forces out in front of you, or put, you know, come up with something thematically first and then come back in and start pointing it up and see what feels right in the system. And then if you don't like it in a game, you know, you're not locked in. Come back and change it up. Mm-hmm, but yeah, the Armies of Mayhem on Wargame Vault is kind of nice. If you have the, you know, traditional GW style armies, it kind of sets you up in an ecosystem where it's kind of like the baseline. You know, you have a typical empire style troop and, you know, orc and goblin army, chaos, elves, wood elves, high elves, you know, and mages and magic and monsters to kind of match each one. So to give you a jump start, if you don't, if, you know, for some people, the sandbox or the toolbox is a little overwhelming. So that gives you a little direction and a little guidance as how to get started.
And then I see that, you know, once we've played a few games in its sort of normal form, there's a section at the end of the book that deals with like sieges and stuff as well. So we could really move into like the defending a castle or attacking a castle or that. So that looks a lot of fun.
And that was, you know, that was another one that's kind of like a nod to the RTS as we kind of like compartmentalize those. So you could, you know, especially if you're playing at the like 10 or 15 millimeter or smaller scales, you could just get a lot of nice blocks of castle things together and, you know, live out those RTS dreams of, you know, taking over and storming the castle and making maneuvers and, you know, garrisoning troops and, yeah, it just adds that little extra layer. And especially if you're really keen on the modeling side, it gives you another excuse to go in and just, you know, make some cool stuff, which is, you know, why we do these hobbies in the first place. I think we like the cool toys. And that's just another opportunity to, you know, flex your modeling muscles and do things.
So from Mayhem to Rogue Planet then, and the background for me personally with Rogue Planet is I actually bought the book a few years ago. Because I just kind of came back into the hobby and adult life and was looking around and I'd heard good things about it. So I picked the book up. But then because I get so few times that I could actually play games, I'd spent all my playing time playing Joe McCulloch's games, Rangers of Shadowdeep mainly. And I'd got Stargrave as well, which looked really cool. And I was collecting, you know, various miniatures of a sci-fi sort of persuasion to put together something for that. And then I was thinking, as cool as Stargrave looks, there are similarities with Frostgrave and Rangers of Shadowdeep, and I wanted to try something different. And I actually went back one day and I picked Rogue Planet back up and I started to read through it. And I thought, no, I'm going to give this a shot first when we're going to, you know, get sci-fi stuff on the table. I want to do this. And I started to read through it and got really excited about various mechanics in it again. So Rogue Planet, Brent, like what would you say what are the key similarities and differences between this game and Mayhem that we've just talked about?
Honestly, if we're they're pretty different games as far as the design goes, but I think in some ways they're going to feel similar because of how dynamic they are. But where you've got, you know, command points and mass battle in Mayhem, Rogue Planet is really cinematic, over the top action. And you know, there's no measurement there. I mean, to start with, there's no measurement. So you don't need a ruler. You don't need anything, to track at all. And it's really about letting you do cool stuff that you see in sci-fi games. If you want to, you know, pick up another model and throw them into something, you can do that. If you want to have terrain that can attack people, it's there. And yeah, there's no movement rules. So you're moving around, your decision points are totally different. And it's got a graded success system. So every time you roll the dice, there's a chance that you're going to give your opponent an opportunity to do something or make a movement or an action. So now instead of just randomly attacking, you really have to think, what are my odds of success? Am I going to let them do something? Is it worth taking this risk? Yeah, they're both freeform and build. They're both pretty dynamic. But yeah, Rogue Planet definitely leans way more into narrative and cinematics and, you know, over the top action. It could be more Final Fantasy, anime, or maybe really more what 40K fluff is, as opposed to gameplay. It's
So
it's a big contrast more than similarities. There are a few, like I said, similar decision points at a few points, but I think they're going to feel very different on the table. That's the intention anyway.
Yeah, and we're looking at this resource management, aren't we? We've got the action points this time, so that works in a similar way, doesn't it?
It does. And here you can spend your action points and go back and forth between units. The big difference is instead of like the overdrive mechanic where we're constantly pushing the same unit over and over, here you can flex back and forth in between units. So you could alternate between a couple of units and then go hit another unit. So yeah, once again, asymmetrical battlefield, but the way that you push is different. The end result is similar though, because you don't have, you know, a movement distance, you're not measuring ranges, so you still get a lot of dynamic movement, and it's really hard to predict where people are going to move and what they're going to do until you kind of get grounded in, you know, creating intercepting models and things like that. But yeah,
with no movement range modifiers, then would you say that the game really benefits from being pretty terrain heavy on the tabletop?
Yeah, I would say either terrain heavy makes it more interesting, or just thoughtful placement of terrain. Anything that's going to, you know, make you triangulate movement or move around and make some straight lines, and also thinking of your troops and like building your armies to engage troops, you know, where you can't just move straight into combat with someone who's further back. So using engaging models and, you know, cannon fodder up front or moving them around sides and flanks in conjunction with your terrain becomes very important in the system. Yeah, I think when you first start with it, though, absolutely. Heavy terrain makes it, you know, much easier to get a grasp on the system and movement rules. And then later on, you can just use a few pieces thoughtfully placed to make for, you know, interesting. I think of it like building a first person shooter level. You know, you want to have areas where different types of things can shine, like sniper alleys versus, you know, CQ things where people are going to get bottlenecked and other things like that. So it gives you a little bit of design element in that sense, I think, when you're making your table more so than other games as to what the vibe's going to be.
What's got your attention right now in the hobby? What are you painting, playing, or planning for this month? Head on over to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail to submit a clip for our monthly hobby update episode. That link again is bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now back to the show. I like the counteract system. We always hear these funny anecdotes of people playing like Warhammer or 40k or that, and it's like, you know, my opponent's turn, so I'm going to make a cup of tea, walk the dog, you know, drive up north, go on holiday, come
right,
back.
Right.
So I really like this idea that we're never out the game. You know, we're never just going and looking out the window, because there's always going to be, or there's usually an opportunity to jump in and spoil something, isn't there?
Yeah. And I agree. You want to be engaged the whole time, and you want to, you know, make your opponent think, hey, if I charge him, is he going to use, you know, those rogue abilities? Are they going to try to shoot at me? Are they going to try to, you know, intercept my movement? And with that graded success system, if they fail, oh, I'm going to get a movement here, or I'm going to get to do, you know, something else. And you can literally pay to interrupt if you've saved some action points. So now you've got, you know, some command points, some action points in your pocket, and you're like waiting to do your thing. So you're watching them, seeing how they're spending, what they're doing, trying to predict movement. So yeah, that's kind of the goal of the game too. Constant interaction, constant, you know, interplay between abilities and pieces. So you get that give and take a little bit.
Can you talk to us a wee bit about the skill checks then?
So skill checks, they're actually based on the Apocalypse World RPG mechanic is what Vince Baker kind of made famous with his game. And it's essentially, after all modifiers, which you can never get more than +3 or -3 on any modifier, not net, but up front. So it keeps things simple. I can roll back to that in a second. But essentially, if you get a 10+, it's a total success. And you're going to get to do an extra action or an extra thing, or it's going to cause an extra ability to fire off. 7 to 9 is a partial success. You did what you wanted to, but, you know, your opponent's going to have some advantage. And then 6 or less is a complete failure. And that's where your opponents can get like activations and things like that. That's the worst result. So you don't want. So now when you're rolling dice, you're obviously trying to get +3. but you also don't want to just overload everything. Like, you know how sometimes you get like, talking about other games where you'll have like 20 miniatures of Smash in the middle because you're trying to get a ton of pluses. Here, once you get plus three, you stop. So there's no need to shove more miniatures or more advantage in there. Same thing. Mm-hmm. Your opponent's only going to get negative three. So it's more about thoughtful use of advantage and disadvantage to get that overall, you know, you get that. It's a window of getting advantage versus I'm going to try to get plus 20 and you're going to get negative 17 for me to get a plus three. It squeezes it down. So now we're not just shoving everything in there in a big scrum. It's let me get a few pieces here. Let me have someone ready to counter a move on the opposite side. And like I said, yeah, because you have a graded success, is it worth the risk of rolling a failure? Is it worth the risk of giving them a partial move? Is it worth that? It's not just, I'm just going to roll all my dice and see what happens. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you've got another decision point. What's the risk worth? And I think when those big risks pay off and you get that total success or a critical success, it feels even bigger in that moment because there was more decision leading up to it as opposed to I'm rolling and it may or may not happen.
When we're putting together our warband or our faction, then we're starting them up with equipment and then they're going to get some enhancements as well, aren't they? So that's sort of like you're just beefing them up with various things that are going to hopefully be effectual for you.
Yeah, and you just and like I said, you could stack as many things as you want, and you could stack multiple weapons to modify something that you have modeled on it. And this is really, this game especially, is whatever model you have, pull it out and just start throwing everything on it so that it can behave like you want it to. So even if there isn't the special laser cannon that you have, just start throwing abilities or mixing and matching to give you the effect that you want and call it a day. So, you know, it's more of a way to tinker with things to get exactly the result you want. And the same thing with like the groups and squads, you know, just if they've got five different weapons, just throw all the different weapon types in there. It doesn't matter. It's all going to come out in the end because it has like a Gestalt principle. You're either going to be able to only use one thing or the two things will stack and you'll limit your results to plus three anyway. So It's kind of a self-regulating system. It's how much do you want to spend on it to make it cool?
Could you talk to us a wee bit about how the combat system works?
Yeah, so combat, as you get into it here, you're rolling those 2d6 and you're getting your modifiers and you're looking for successes. But based on different types of enemy types, you're going to take damage. And that damage can either be used to eliminate models or from a shared energy pool. Think about like a shared HP pool between your force. And you can use that to, you know, you can eliminate energy instead of units. And that kind of gives you an option to say, hey, is this guy cannon fodder? Do I need to save him to because of his great abilities? Or do I want to keep him there to keep this guy locked up? So, you know, and also, oh, I really like this cool model. I'm going to pay whatever it takes to keep it on the table because this is what I wanted to highlight today. So, the combat, besides the modifiers and the graded success, is really about how much damage are you going to do and how do you mitigate the damage. And like I said, having a shared health pool, you're either eliminated or you pay the amount of energy to keep them on the table. And it eliminates record keeping, but yet gives you a lot of granularity without overhead, I think.
Yeah, and another great way of doing that seems to be this pawn system. Like, it seems to be a very good visual way of showing a character's health. So, for the listener, could you maybe explain the pawn system and how it sort of works?
Yeah, so the pawn system is, and this is one of the things I personally love about the system. The pawn system was inspired for me by like in-game bosses or that you would fight in like a video game. And I thought, you know, as they go along and you're defeating them, they usually lose abilities or powers. They get less than. And so I'm thinking, how do I model that on the table and how can I get other cool models? So the pawn system is you basically have your hero model, whoever, whatever they are, and then you have these pawns that assist them. They don't really take up space on the table or anything like that, but they each give you a power or ability. And they're kind of like your leader's personal pool of points. So now as they take damage, you have to say, do I remove this thing that causes terror? Do I have these grunts that give me two pawns instead of one? Do I just let them go as fodder? Do I keep the one that gives me an increased command range? So it gives you a feeling I'm fighting this epic battle against this guy. I'm taking them down, and they have the decision point of what am I willing to lose to keep him in the game? What's better for me at this moment? And you have these cool models that, you know, like command retinues from 40K and other games or stuff like that. You can now model all that on the table. It's not taking up space or doing a thing, but it's actually providing you real gameplay, no bookkeeping or record keeping, and it adds to the visual spectacle. So, Yeah, the pawns, I was really proud of the way those turned out. And I think it's for people who like to model things, it's a great opportunity to kind of really go crazy.
Yeah, as somebody who just like collects miniatures that I like the look of from any company, I like this because, in fact, I love it because there's just a lot of miniatures I've never been able to fit into games. Whereas the pawn system, it's a great opportunity to say, okay, now this guy can be involved because he's going to be this special ability. That's what he's going to represent. And fair enough, like you say, nobody could actually shoot him. He can't fight anyone, but he's on the table, you know. He's part of the spectacle, and it's just this really cool way of getting models on the table. And again, it gives that, it's almost like a visual indicator of health, isn't it? Because the more pawns you see disappearing, you know that this guy's getting weaker as well.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I made it for, because I'm the same way. I would have all these miniatures from companies. I'm like, I don't want to play their game, but that particular mini is so cool. I want to get it on the table. You know, and the other thing, not only are they part of the spectacle, but like when we play, me and my buddies, and we're playtesting and doing things, we always like the narrative side. So a pawn that's doing something, even though they have no, you know, technically physical presence tactically on the table, we will move them around over here to be like, oh, they're harassing, or the radio man. We'll actually move the piece around. So we'll have pawns all over the board because we know what they are, but we shift them to kind of tell the story of what effect they're having or what they're doing. Or, you know, if you're protecting one, we'll move it in front of our guy, even though they're not technically there protecting. It's just another chance for, you know, story, I think, and to reinforce the story that you're telling through the miniature. So not only they're like a pool of hit points, but they're also telling the story of what they're doing and giving you a chance to further create that image on the table that you have in your head of what's going on.
Yeah, I see this as a way to almost get that, like what is thought of as a 40K sized army on the table without all the extra bookkeeping and without the extra hours designed to, you know, take care of all these characters. They're on the table. You know, you could have a big force on the table, but they could be pawns. So I think it's a really great feature of the game. I found how many pawns you could use. It seems to be based on the mission level. Is that right? Like, depending on how many pawns you could take.
Yes. So mission level, yeah, it just determines, it's basically the higher the mission level, the more pawns you can take, because it's determining the power level of the game and what your hero's level is. And then the number of pawns, you know, like I said, there's some pawns like the grunts that allow you to take two pawns instead of one because they're just fodder. But I would also say, if people are playing the game and they want to bring more, as long as you and your opponent agree to the same thing, it'll all come out in the wash for the most part. So, yeah, if you want to stretch the system and do some other things, you know, rules as written, it's designed to keep you in kind of like a box where playtime and balance and, you know, all that's in there. But, you know, for people who want to like go crazy and have super powered heroes and stuff, just increase the points value or just increase the number of pawns and figure out what you like the feel of.
What about the rogue die system then? Could you talk to us a wee bit about that?
Yeah, so the rogue die is essentially a rogue die. We're rolling 2d6 for everything. And the rogue die is a different colored die that you throw in the mix. And when it matches one of the other two die, it's either going to cancel it out. And if it creates a failure, it's going to create effect. Or if it matches one of the die on a success, it's going to have an effect. So we use these for, you know, power weapons or return fire or all sorts of different melee attacks. And it just gives you, it's another way for you to interact and interrupt what your opponent's doing, or to model the chance of something big happening when you're using a weapon. You know, and it, from the math side, it allows you to do some interesting things because of the 2d6 matching one. It's the calculations are easy to calculate on the back end for a value for points, if that makes sense, from a design perspective. but it's a lot harder for someone to gauge on the tabletop, you know, what the odds of it being a success are by the time they get a plus two modifier and then the die, and is it going to match and what is the chance of success, unless they have it ready on a sheet of paper. And to me, that keeps you more in the game and your choices intuitive, as opposed to you mathing out what you're going to do. And I think that bit of fog and grayness around how the statistics of the rogue die work make for better play and more interesting play and keep the game moving.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, rogue die is for, you know, making exciting stuff happen and giving you a chance. And when it does happen, a lot of those effects, like when you're intercepting someone or when you're doing counterfire, they're huge. Like if a rogue die matches with a six and causes a failure on a shooting, that would be six damage going back the other way towards the unit. So most people aren't going to give that much damage away. But if it's towards the end of the game, it's a tough choice. Do I let this unit go who's got some power and some wounds, or do I put, you know, do I take six of my energy out of what's probably a limited pool anyway? So they're big moments in the game too when the rogue dice hit, typically.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this rule set because of the different opportunities. I really like narrative and story, and you know, some of the things that we see in the book, some of the examples that are given are like, you know, picking miniatures up and throwing them into electric fences and stuff like that. Really cinematic and fun, kind of. And do you feel that that's a big part of your ethos? Because we see elements of it in both these games, and no doubt the other stuff you create too. Just that almost video game style. Fun at times that you kind of try and put into these games.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, video games are a huge source of inspiration for me, and I really like to put that feeling on the tabletop. I know we haven't talked about it today, but like, you know, my tabletop football game, Techno Bowl, is kind of based on like old NFL Blitz and things like that, and it's the same thing. I want that feeling of I'm creating plays and running things and the chances for big things to happen. And Rogue Planet and Mayhem are the same. Designing for a feeling or the vibe that it elicits on the table is just as important to me as the tactics and the mechanics. So I usually start from a theme standpoint when I design. I think most people should. And I think it comes through in your design. If you say, I want to make a sci fantasy game, what are the elements that are important? And then you design for it. Same thing. I want to make a tabletop sports game, or I want to make a mass battle game. What does that feel like? What I want people to think about in the moment. But for sure, narrative is to me always important and comes up top. I want it to be balanced. I want it to be tactical, but it should feel thematic, and everything that you do should reinforce theme and narrative. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you, you've touched on your other game there, and I want to ask you about your other games and projects in a second, but just a final thing on these two games, Rogue Planet and Mayhem, what like are the communities online around them? Is there a lot of community interaction around the games and a lot of folks playing them and reaching out to you with different stuff around them?
There are a lot around both of them. Rogue Planet actually has a really like big hardcore community, and one that does a lot of house rules and like the Berman blog online. It's linked from like my website and things. You'll see his stuff. A guy in Australia, he just puts out amazing like 40K and Inquisitor specific rules, and the Baron's blog online. He's another guy. He just does a ton of Mayhem stuff. Yeah. And you know, even like on the Wargame Vault site itself, like Rogue Planet, I think we have like the comment section for most games on there, like on the reviews, have like two or three comments. I think that one has like something crazy, like 200 comments. And it's just, yeah, I think once they get it on the table and like experience it, you know, guys who are hardcore war gamers, when they first pick it up, I don't think it resonates when they read it at first. So they really have to get it on the table. But once they do, I think they realize like, oh, this is something different, and kind of takes the, you know, the chains off, you know, that you had from other games that lock you in these boxes. And once they get in there, yeah, it's exciting. So yeah, communities are good. They're strong. And the people who are really active in it put out a lot of content. It makes me feel good. And always like to give a shout out to them and all that they do.
Yeah. It is one, like, one recurring comment that I've seen was stuff around like Rogue Planet is kind of complicated and inaccessible. And me, like, I consider myself not particularly intelligent, certainly not when it comes to interpreting rules. And I've you know, I understand it. I had to ask you a wee bit some pieces today, but I get it. Like, I can't wait to put it on the table, and I really don't see it as complicated, more just like you've said, different.
Yeah, and I think you just hit on the prime point. I think because it's different, most rule sets that you go into are derivative in some way on the classics. So they have classic turn structures and phases and interactions. Even dice systems are similar. So when you go into Rogue Planet, where basically every single system in it was custom made for the game, but they're not in any other system. So people don't have that familiarity, so it feels complicated. I think the people who love it the most are people who have never been miniature gamers, or people who like pick it up to get their kids into games and put it on the table, like, oh, this is easy and fast. And, you know, the same type of people who would play Song of Blades and Heroes, I think, enjoy Rogue Planet and Mayhem. And then it bleeds into other audiences as they play longer. I think people who are further along in their wargaming journey will then turn to these games and hopefully find something that they like. But yeah, I sometimes people will be like, oh, this doesn't make sense. And they'll start telling me why it doesn't make sense. I'm like, oh, you're trying to completely turn it into Warhammer or, War Master. It's not that. Just take it for what it is. And, you know, a video play will make all the difference. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But yeah, I see that in the table and board games that I design too, sometimes because, you know, everyone's played a deck builder. So when you put out a new deck builder, it seems like, oh, everyone knows the rule, but the first one didn't have those issues. So anytime you do something the first time, it's always going to meet a little resistance, or there's going to be a little skill gap in learning it, I think. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad to say that you said it's pretty easy, because I think most people who come in without a hardcore wargaming background are just, boom, they pick it up and they're right in.
Yeah, it's like almost that curse of knowledge sometimes for people. Like, you know, 20 years of playing Warhammer this way, they just assume that that's how everything works. So
yeah, and those assumptions always get in the way of interpreting something else. So so true.
So what you mentioned American football there. What was the game called?
Techno Bowl. You know, it's a little play on the old Tecmo Bowl, but yeah, it's it uses a similar success system from Rogue Planet, but you literally build your formations on the fly, and you set up your cards and you do your little gameplay. But because of the varied success, when you're doing blocks or doing things like that, you can cue extra activations, so you can open up gaps and run the play, or throw a perfect pass to a guy and he runs downfield, or you fail and they get to reverse moves and do things. So it's pretty dynamic. I think even if you're not a American football fan, if you like war games or tactical games, it's people find it a lot of fun, I think, in the wargaming community, because it's, you know, there's threat zones and you're doing things and you're moving guys, and it's self, you know, all the stuff on the print and play is self-contained, so you can make, you know, a couple of teams pretty quickly and get some games in. But yeah, it's another one that I really wanted to hit that same itch that those video games get, with the extra added of making your own formations and plays, which you can't do. So you're constantly creating and trying to figure out what your opponent's doing, and it's been well received. It was my first actual board game that was produced. So
is that a miniatures game then, or is it counters?
No, it's a board game, and the production one had like typical punch standees, but I did little pixel block players for the others that are print and play, and now we have like sticker sets. So you basically take a 3/4 inch wooden or plastic block and model these football players around them. So it's got their numbers on the top, and their stats are totally tied to their player number. So everything you need to know is in the jersey number. So once you see the jersey number and have the placement, you've got everything you need to know. So yeah, there's a tabletop simulator mod for it too. So people play online. So if you ever, like, you know, get the rules or want to like have a game or something, yeah, it's on there. It's not quite as fast moving online, but the mod's really, really good. The guy who did the mod is fantastic, and it's got a really active community, and that game's played all over the world. I'm always getting people who are running leagues in Spain, England, France. And
any other wee games that we should touch on as well? So the website, is it Bombshell Games is your website?
Mm-hmm.
Bombshell-games.com is the URL. I'll put it in the show notes, obviously. But any other games there that you want to give a wee shout out to while we're talking about them?
The new wrestling game I'm working on. It's World of Wrestling. It's basically like the old Nintendo 64 WCW versus NWO wrestling games with parodied wrestlers and abilities. And yeah, there's a Board Game Geek thread on it in the works in progress section, and just super stoked for it. It's pretty exciting and super thematic. I've actually created a little like physics engines for all the moves so that slams and pile drivers and suplexes look like they should in the game and have like tactical effects. And yeah, I think war gamers will, you know, really, really love it. And it's going to be cool. I'm pretty excited for what's going to happen with it.
Yeah, I like the look of that. As somebody who grew up with WWF in the early 90s, I'll be looking forward to revisiting that. I had a Commodore 64 game of wrestling. It was a bit two-dimensional, but I'm sure this will be a lot more fun.
I remember the Commodore 64 Amiga days. Yeah, those were good times.
So, Brent, where can folks keep up with you online? Where could they find out more about when these games come out and any new projects that you're working on as well?
My website, I update infrequently, but the things are there, bombshell-games.com. I'm on Twitter, at TheBrentSpivey. So I, once again, not super active, but when something new is coming up, I'll link it there. Usually if it's a board game, I have a works in progress section on Board Game Geek, and I'll link to it from Twitter. The other thing I'm going to start doing, I just like a month ago set up a Twitch channel where we want to start broadcasting some board games and some prototype design stuff so people can kind of see and interact while I'm doing that. Because, you know, there's so much time for development that people don't, that I'm not interacting with people because I'm in design mode. It would be a good chance for people who are interested in that way to either A, see games that I already have, what we're doing with them, or new designs, or just kind of get chats and updates. And that's also my Twitch channel is going to be at the Brent Spivey. And hopefully next month, I just got the channel kind of situated right now. It's just me and my friends playing some games. But hopefully in a month, we'll give away a couple of copies of Techno Bowlers, like two copies left in shrink wrap in the world. And we're going to give those away on a raffle. That's a hard to come by game. I managed to source a couple of copies. I haven't told anyone else this, so you're the first to know. Yeah, we're going to give a couple of copies away on a raffle just as a way to kind of drive some engagement, because I think it's going for like $200 to $300 on the secondary market in some places. Okay. Like 150. Yeah. So that'll be a nice grab for someone, I think.
Thanks very much to Callum for doing the intro this week. This is exactly why I couldn't do it myself.